show you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the fifth episode of Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I am Sierra Houck, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Jackie DeVore.
Hello.
And Melissa Megan.
Hello.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Pretty all right. Pretty all right.
Feel like we've all kind of had a hard week.
Yeah. Try to be optimistic about that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Been a rough weekend.
Kind of been a hard year, huh?
A little bit.
But actually, if you look up at your calendar, magically it's halfway over. The entire year is already halfway over.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. And I bet you guys don't even know what your Halloween costumes are going to be.
Oh my God, I don't.
I've definitely come up with like 8 different ideas throughout the year that I'm like, that's going to be it. And then I come up with something else.
Yeah, I do that too.
I need to stop recording right now so I can play in my Halloween costume. We sort of, we go through a month right after Halloween where we talk about it nonstop and have a bunch of ideas and then forget about it for like 6 months and then have to go back to it again.
Yeah.
I do that same thing, and it got so bad I literally started a Trello board that I just add on to throughout the year. Like, nice. I'm going to do this to the house. I want to do this for a costume. This would make a great group costume. Like all that nonsense.
That's smart. I never get as far as writing it down. I might tweet something as a joke. And then I'll go back and try to find it, and I can never find it.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I feel like we also put a little bit too much power into Max's hands for Halloween, because he really loves Halloween and costumes. So we keep asking him, what do you want to be for Halloween? What do you want to be for Halloween? And, like, you know, most toddlers, he changes his mind about 6 times through the year, so.
Right.
And then it's, you know, then it's a month before Halloween and you're rushing to get whatever you can grab off Amazon.
That's so cool that he's really into Halloween and costumes, though. He's going to have a really fun childhood.
Yeah.
He loves it. He loves it.
It's a good thing he's not rebelling against you guys being all like, I hate horror and movies.
Halloween sucks.
I hate Star Wars.
As long as he doesn't make me wear a cat suit again this year, he needs to choose more appropriate costumes for his mommy until I get back into better shape.
What was Max last year?
We did the Avengers last year. He was Yeah, he was Thor, and he had long hair at the time, which he kept long so he could be Thor. And then he made me do Black Widow, and he made Dad do the Incredible Hulk.
Nice.
So... which Ryan is very tall and slender, so he had to buy one of those, like, puffy, filled up muscle Hulk costumes.
Big muscles.
Yeah, it had, like, puffy, filled muscles, and we ended up hiding the Hulk costume within a week after Halloween, because every day he would walk in the door from work, and Max would demand that he puts the Hulk smash costume back on. Calls it a Hulk smash.
Nice.
So he'd walk in the door, he'd yell, Dad, be Hulk smash, be Hulk smash. So the Hulk smash costume is now hiding in the garage somewhere.
That's hilarious.
Well, hopefully Max doesn't listen to the podcast.
No.
All right. Well, are we ready to talk about some recommendations?
I think so.
Melissa, what are you loving this week?
Okay. I'm going to recommend something that's really old, but I don't care because this is my first time playing it. And I had a really great time, so I wanted to share it. Recommending Stubbs the Zombie in Rebel Without a Pulse. I'm interested in whether Jackie's played this game or not.
I feel like I've started to play that before, but didn't get fully into it.
It's from 2006. Well,
okay,
sorry. It was available in Europe in 2006. It was 2007 that it was actually available here. But yeah, it's pretty old. It is a really fun third-person action game where you get to play as the zombie. And you work your way through a modern city called Punch Bowl, where robots and people coexist, this futuristic city. And the main goal is to turn other people into zombies to fight alongside you, either by eating their brains or beating them to death. So you can throw explosive body parts at them, you can drive various vehicles over them, or you can just run up to them and eat their brains.
Well, that sounds like the kind of city I want to live in.
It's wonderful. And I was really pleasantly surprised at how sort of gory it was. Every time you eat their brains, the blood just squirts everywhere and the person screams. For a game from 2007, special effects weren't really great back then, but I wouldn't call it 8-bit either. It's mm-hmm. I think it's actually pretty nice effects for what was coming out at that time. And every time you turn people into zombies, they kind of become your horde, and you can whistle to call them to you, or you can shove them to try to sort of push your zombie horde in a particular direction to get them to help you eat other people. And
where do the robots factor in? Are they attacking you?
In the beginning, they don't. It's really cool. Actually, one of the robots are one of the first things that you meet in the new world. You wake up in this, your Stubbs crawls out of the ground in the opening scene and interrupts this cute little picnic between a couple on the grass. And you meet this robot who's sort of like a tour guide. And she's this really cheery woman who's just showing you around the city while you eat people along the way. And she's really positive and optimistic. She's just kind of like, oh, okay, so you did that. You should probably get out of here now before they come and shoot you. It's just tons of fun. And you use these zombie hordes. You can also use them sort of defensively, where you send them out in front of you and you kind of let them, because you do face off against a lot of military people and kind of large group of armed people trying to kill all the zombies because you're in the horde now. So you can send the horde out in front of you to sort of block your way and clear a path for you.
Nice. Sacrificial zombies.
Right. And it's a bit of a side scroller in that, you can go back a little bit. You can like backtrack and go back into a building that you've left. But it very much sort of pushes you forward to the next phase of the game. It's always kind of directing you where to go next to progress. So it's really silly and it's really fun. It gets a little bit repetitive, but honestly, it never got old. The thrill of turning people into zombies and just eating brains everywhere.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's got a really great sense of humor, pretty juvenile sense of humor, like fart and body humor. But it's really fun. And you go up against, like I said, military people. There is a character who is this really obnoxious sort of rednecky guy who's got a bunch of really silly caricatures of country guys with like ripped up pants and big hats, and they have their big rifles and they're chasing you around. Some of it is pretty challenging because you're going after people with like laser guns or big rifles, and you're just this slow moving old zombie and you can't pick up weapons at all. You just have to sort of throw exploding body parts at them.
Arguably a weapon, but yeah.
Yeah, you just eat more brains and it eventually gives you extra brains to throw at people. So... Yeah,
well, that works.
It's really silly and really fun, but I had a blast with it, and so I'm going to recommend it, because if you missed it, like I did, I think I missed it because Ryan actually played it, and so I decided to sit it out and just watch him, and I went back onto my 360. It's on 360. It's also on Windows and Mac OS X, so I went back onto my 360 and decided to dig out some old games, and this is the one I ended up playing, and I just had a blast with it.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that's that one. My other recommendation is a comic book series called Clean Room. And this is written by Gail Simone with art by John Davis Hunt. There are some really, really gorgeous covers by Jenny Frisson. She also does some beautiful covers for another horror series called Revival. And Clean Room has been out for a while. I think volume one is available already, which means there's, anywhere, I think I'm up to maybe like issue number 11 or 12. It's a really interesting book. At the beginning, I wasn't sure if I was going to love it, but by, I'd say, issue three, I've been hooked on it. It's about an enigmatic and seemingly cold as ice self-help leader who claims that she can see the demons hiding in the shadows all around us.
Cool.
Yeah. She claims that they perch themselves over our shoulders, very, very literally sit on people's shoulders and sort of influence their lives in terrible ways and make them do terrible things. And she's the only one who can see them. And her followers appear to find great wealth and success, but they often die brutal deaths. And when a journalist named Chloe Pierce loses her fiancé under Astrid Mueller's influence, she dedicates her life to finding out why and how. Astrid is the name of the leader of this group. Very, obviously very wealthy, very powerful woman who everyone sort of treats like a god. Astrid takes her followers to something called the Clean Room, which is where your worst fears and moments are revealed to you. they go into this very surreal but highly monitored mental state where all the most terrible things in your life are laid out in front of you. And it's presented to people in a way that this is going to open your eyes, this is going to enlighten you, this is going to take you to a different level. It's very Scientology. It reminds me a lot of Scientology, this idea that you're going to move to a different level within the ranks every time you do one of these, go through one of these experiences, and you reveal more of yourself. And you're always being tested. There's very strict rules that you have to follow to be a part of this association. It seems like everyone who is a high member of this association has a lot of money, is very successful, but people are dropping off and dying these horribly brutal deaths. One of the first deaths in this book, they find a homeless man who was a follower of hers and sort of fell from grace. They find him tied into knots.
Wow.
Arms and legs twisted around each other. And yeah, it's pretty gory and brutal.
Does it seem like it's meant as kind of a shot at Scientology specifically, or just coincidentally similar?
The further I get into it, it feels like that. It definitely feels like that. Because, you know, between these demons that she sees are being pushed as aliens at this point. That's what they seem to be being sold as. Like, they're demons from some other place that have decided to reside here and mess with our world. You know, from Astrid Mueller being this really high-ranking, super powerful woman who can snap her fingers, and she's got these bodyguards constantly with her. She's got all of this entire team of people who are a well-oiled machine doing exactly what she wants them to do, down to all of these tests and things that they're, challenges that they're putting their members through constantly to test their loyalty and to test whether or not they follow the rules and whether or not they're believing what they're supposed to be believing. It feels a lot like Scientology. If it's not, then it's a really big coincidence.
Yeah.
That sounds really cool in a creepy, imitating real life kind of way.
It's incredibly creepy. It's really, really creepy. And I get the feeling now that I'm further into it that it seems like maybe Astrid definitely has some kind of personal vendetta that she is using this group to fuel. She's using this group to get some kind of closure with these demons. She's trying to accomplish something.
That's interesting.
So yeah, it's the story's getting more and more complex as it goes on. And Chloe is the journalist whose fiance killed himself I think it was 3 days or 3 weeks after he read Astrid Mueller's book. And she gets very close to Astrid Mueller, starts trying to destroy her empire and stop people from dying, and sort of inadvertently becomes mixed up in the association and becomes involved in some really heavy things that she wasn't supposed to be involved in.
Those don't sound like enemies you want to have.
No. No, Astrid Mueller is an incredibly engaging, interesting character. She's this beautiful woman with long red hair, and she's got this big gray streak down one side. And she's always dressed immaculately in these head-to-toe, like, pink and white, really severe laboratory medical-feeling outfits. And extremely collected and calm at all times. She's very, at first I thought she was completely unemotionless. Like, maybe she's Vulcan,
just a sociopath, but yeah.
Yeah, she's just a complete sociopath. And
I don't know about you guys, but to me, the really calm and collected villains are the ones that scare me the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, they just seem so confident. They're gonna get you. They know something you don't.
Yeah. So Clean Room is a comic series. I think if you're not reading the series, you're really missing out on one of the best comic books being written right now. It's really incredible.
It sounds like it's not too far in either, so you can catch up fairly easily, right?
Yeah, no, and sometimes the best way to catch up on comic book stories like these are to read them, you know, just like TV shows. It's really, sometimes I think it's more fun to just marathon it and get a big chunk of things, and then you can read it almost like a book rather than little issues. Yeah, especially when it's a more complex story like this. I'll probably go back and reread this one when it's over, just because I'm sure there's things that I've missed along the way.
That sounds awesome.
Jackie, what are your recs this week?
I have a couple of recommendations that are actually right on the level with what we're going to talk about today. And I think it's just because I couldn't get my head out of that sci-fi horror space. Honestly, I just love the genre. But the first one is Fringe, and it's a little bit older. It ended in 2013. When we first started watching it, I started watching this with my husband because I kept hearing really good things about it, but I didn't know what to expect really. And as soon as we got into it, we got like two episodes into it, and I was like, this is like a modern day X-Files. Where has this been? Because we started watching it like well after it was canceled. So we weren't watching it like as the episodes were coming out, and I was like kicking myself for not doing so, like for not watching it the whole time, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen Fringe because it seems like it's just become a staple in the genre these days. But if you haven't, or if it's been a while since you've seen it, I would highly recommend going back. It holds up, for one, and it holds up for multiple viewings. I probably watched it through like three times now, and I'm not even kidding when I say we watched it after it was canceled. So that's kind of a lot in a
that's
short
a big commitment
of time. Yeah. It's one of those shows where I'm like, god, I'm bored, I want to watch something interesting that's not gonna let me down. Ooh, Fringe. It's on Netflix. Yay.
How many seasons did that have? Like five or six?
That had five seasons.
Five seasons.
And the first couple of seasons are very much, they're methodical. They're very much modern day X-Files kind of thing, where you have the FBI agents jumping into these supernatural cases. The curveball here is Walter, the mad scientist, who is, I mean, somebody I just want to kidnap and make my grandfather. But he's played by John Noble, who is just the most adorable man that was ever created. But Walter, he kind of has a childlike mind, but he's also a brilliant scientist at the same time. And he has a very, very dark and detailed past that you go into throughout the entire series. But what's particularly interesting about Fringe, I think, is the fact that they deal in parallel universes. And they deal with a parallel universe that one of the team members specifically created. And I don't want to give a whole lot away for people who haven't seen the series, but it's very interesting in the way they delve into what you do in this universe is going to completely and utterly fuck up the lives of people in this other universe. And it's, you know, stuff that we've theorized as humans over years. And of course, we've never proven because we haven't crossed over to a parallel universe yet. But the way that they go through this is very entertaining. They also bring in time travelers from the future who come back. And at first, they're just there to watch big events happen. So you can pinpoint when a big event in that universe is going to happen because there'll be a watcher nearby. And then they become part of the story. And then you get to about season three and they completely flip the entire thing on you. And just, it was almost like they knew that they were going to be canceled and they were like, fuck this, we're going to do what we want. And it was kind of incredible. When we got to season three, my husband and I were both like, are we still watching the same show? Like, is this honestly what we've been watching for a couple of seasons now? Because not only do they flip it around with the whole parallel universe and the future visitors and all that, they just really turn the entire world upside down. And then when you get up to season five, they flip it again. And I honestly think the writers were sitting there like, you know what, guys, we know we're going to get canceled. This isn't going to be the show that's going to last a decade like the X-Files did. Let's just have some fun with this. What did you really ever want to see on the screen? Let's make this happen. It's a lot of fun. In the season five run, the whole team ends up being in the future. And the future has been taken over by these creepy observer dudes. And it's very 1984 Orwellian kind of future. And it's pretty insane.
I always hoped for a Walter spinoff.
Yeah.
From that show.
Yeah, it was wanted Walter.
I love
too.
That crazy old son of a bitch so much. He's amazing. Was so fun, especially when he was angry with somebody.
I loved his cow. Anytime he brought up the cow, it would make my day. But so my other recommendation is something that is brand new and it's on Netflix right now. It's Stranger Things, and you guys are going to hear this a few days after we record it, but it was just released like yesterday, I think. Maybe the day before?
Like, I think Friday the 15th?
Yeah, that sounds right. I've only watched the first couple of episodes, so my recommendation is really going to come from a newbie on this, but Stranger Things seems to be a callback to the 1980s very much so. It's very, very heavily relies on 80s nostalgia cues. Personally, that's not something I love, in that I almost didn't watch it at all because I'm just not a huge fan of the 80s. but I just kept hearing how incredible it was, so I had to take a look. I'm still just a couple of episodes in. I'm hoping Sierra has more to add to this. But so far, there's some really nice pacing and some great thematic work in terms of a sci-fi horror. And they're setting it up to basically be like a big Stephen King-esque burrito.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Stephen King does burritos?
Yes. It's like basically elements from all these Stephen King stories wrapped up into this big 80s nostalgia.
Wrapped up in a big flour tortilla. Yeah, no, I am maybe 6 or 7 episodes in right now, and I've been loving it. It's also, I'd say, not so 1980s heavy where it's just references after references. It's more of just a feeling.
Yeah, they get that feeling down perfectly.
Absolutely. They have some kind of music references to the 80s and 70s, but it also has a really good score that also just kind of has that like weird synth kind of horror movie, like George Romero, Dawn of the Dead kind of feel, which I love so much. But
yeah, that is something I noticed with the music. It's like very nicely timed, so it's not, you know, overpowering, and it comes in at like just the right moment. So whomever's doing their sound design and their composing there is really on top of it.
Doing a great job.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about this, but what's the premise here? Like, what's happening?
So there is a boy and he goes missing, and his friends decide to go and find him. And his parents, you know, worried that he's dead. The town all kind of decide he's dead. His body shows up, but it's all very like kind of covered up weirdly. Like the state doesn't really let the local police near it at all. And it starts to unfold that there's this big conspiracy surrounding this research lab that's in the town, and it turns out that there's this guy who's like pretty much owns the whole town. And then the best part, in my opinion, is the character Eleven, who's this little girl who shows up, and she's escaped from this medical and test facility, and you realize that she has powers pretty quickly.
Yeah, and she's this adorable, slightly creepy little girl that you just really want to know a lot more about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it. And you want to protect her.
Yeah.
And so it's discovering what's going on with this weird facility. There are weird monsters. It's like, where is this boy gone? There's a lot of, you just get lost, but it's okay because it's all really interesting. And a lot of the time you're like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm still going to keep watching.
And it seems like there's a pretty strong extraterrestrial overlay here. I don't know if it actually turns out to be aliens. I'm still pretty early into it, but it certainly seems like it's going to be aliens.
So it's kind of a like sci-fi horror murder mystery.
Yeah.
All wrapped up.
Yeah.
Is that what you meant by a Stephen King burrito?
No, man. There were like very specific references to like Stephen King in this.
Oh, okay.
And honestly, I don't want to mention too many of them without giving them away. So I'm just going to recommend that you watch that one. You.
Got it.
You.
Me. I will watch it.
And it's all on Netflix right now, so it's easy.
I will watch it, I promise.
Netflix has been killing it with the originals lately, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I know this isn't a comedy podcast, but I've loved Lady Dynamite that just came out, this Maria Bamford show.
I was thinking in my head, Sierra. I just listened to the Nerdist episode this morning with her on it. And I was laughing all the way to work and back home listening to it. And I thought, I gotta see this show because this lady is hilarious.
Mm-hmm. You should definitely watch it.
It was like a crazy person in my car just laughing out loud to myself all the way to work.
Pretty appropriate for Maria Bamford, anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, so this week I want to recommend an artist that I recently discovered. Her name is Eliza Gager, and she runs this website called problemglyphs.org, glyphs. And I discovered her because I found a sticker that she had designed that is a hex protecting trans folk. And it was pasted on a lamppost in downtown Seattle, and it had a skull and symbols and everything on it, and all of this like little writing that kind of brought you in. And it basically said, this is to protect trans people. And now that you've kind of glanced at this, it's going to worm its way into your mind and it's going to change all of your preconceived notions about these people.
That's so cool.
And now you're going to work as a person to protect them. And I loved that she combined this kind of witchy idea of symbols and protective spells and hexes and things and people who need protection. And so I went to her website, problemglyphs.org, and she's done over 200 of these little glyphs and hexes for people who write into her. It's a lot of people with chronic illnesses or negative relationships or things like that, people who are kind of down on their luck or having a hard time. And a lot of people have gotten their glyphs tattooed on them, which I think is really cool. And she's just really positive and awesome. And I really like her art style.
I'm just glancing through her Tumblr right now and reading this hex of I don't know how you say it. Obsolescence, which I believe is what you're referring to, that protects trans kids.
Mm-hmm.
It says the sigil protects trans kids. The sigil harms the bodies, minds, and concepts of those who refuse to mind their own fucking business.
Yeah, and she has a great sense of humor.
Yeah, this that's sign awesome. That's like taped on a pole in front of a business.
Yeah, so I just, you know, came across her by happenstance.
That's
and
so
I'm not
awesome.
Sure if she's local, but I think she's really cool.
Looks like she's been running a Kickstarter for a printed book, too.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it's been funded.
Yeah, cool.
Which is awesome. She's doing good work. And so my other recommendation is the podcast Tanis. I've been listening to it nonstop this week. It is done by the same people who do the Black Tapes podcast, which is kind of like scary stories. But this one is a narrative broken up in, so far they've done 2 seasons worth of podcasts, and it's about this kind of huge conspiracy and cult around this idea of Tanis, which is this thing that it's a place, but it's also maybe a being, and it moves around, and it's all very mysterious and covered up, and it's been talked about through all of history, and there's a city in ancient Egypt called Tanis, and they were thinking that Tanis was named after the city in Egypt, but really the city was named after Tanis, kind of thing. And so at first I was thinking it was kind of be similar to lore or something like that, where it's a new kind of story every time. But the way that the story has developed has been really nice because it involves a lot of different true crime or history or any other like mythologies and ties them all together into this bigger plot. So it's fictional, but it's based off of different types of history and truth coming together. And the way that the guy kind of puts it all together, it's a bunch of different interviews, and he has a character that he works with who is this computer science genius, and she finds information for him, and they come across all of these different people who are either very nice or very mean to them and want to hurt them or want to help them. So I've been listening to that all week, and it's been so good.
I love that we can recommend all of these other podcasts that we admire and have fun with.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you should definitely keep listening to us because we're obviously the best one out there, but...
Sure, yep.
There are others.
But these guys are doing good work, too. Yeah. So, yeah, the Tanis podcast. You should check that out. And I would say stick with it for a couple of episodes because it's a little... You feel like you kind of know what it's going to be based off the first episode, but then it expands a lot more beyond that. So
awesome.
Do you guys have anything else you want to recommend or talk about?
I think I'm ready to talk about some sci-fi and horror.
Let's get into it.
Cool. Me too. Let's take a little break and play some music, and we'll start talking about horror and sci-fi and all of the places in between. We are back. Let's talk about sci-fi and horror. Yay. Hooray! So I think we should start kind of where... Let's start at the beginning.
At the very beginning?
At the very beginning.
The very beginning.
I think that before we started recording, we were kind of kicking around some ideas of where modern sci-fi and horror maybe got their start. Who are the big influencers?
In the beginning, before men.
There was horror. And the name that immediately came up was Mary Shelley.
Yeah.
Pioneer.
I honestly, I've been thinking about this for the past couple weeks in preparing for this episode. And I honestly think Frankenstein may have been the very first sci-fi horror story.
I've seen that idea thrown out there in many articles that I've been reading on this subject, that the consensus seems strong on that, Jackie.
Yeah. And there's been a screenshot of a quote on Tumblr kicking around lately. You may have even seen it on my Twitter a while back, but it's by C-Change, S-E-A, hyphen change. And this person says, Mary fucking Shelley. Oh, I'm a 19-year-old female in a world where females are basically valued only as mothers, grieving over the loss of my child, disowned by my father, in dire financial straits, stuck in a country that's not my own, ignored and cheated on by my husband, and belittled by my husband's friends. How am I going to deal with this? Why don't I completely change the rules of literature, motherfuckers? And while I'm at it,
yeah,
I'll simultaneously invent an entire new genre and write the first non-religious creation myth.
Hell yeah.
Which, like, sums it up better than I could ever imagine to myself. So, good
she
on you, C-Change, for that one.
I didn't realize that she was so young when she wrote it.
I didn't either.
I had always heard that it was this friendly wager because her husband was a horror writer and she was a romance writer or something. I don't even know if that's true now.
Yeah.
But that was always the story of, like, I'll write a love story if you write a horror story. And his story was crap and hers is, like, history. Hers is legend now.
Do you know, is that actually what happened, Jackie? Do you know them?
I'm pretty sure what C-Change there mentioned is exactly how it went down.
Her husband probably made up that whole bet thing afterwards because he wanted to take some credit in being involved.
Yeah, say that it was his idea for her to write it. Yeah.
Yeah,
we know the truth.
Well, she wouldn't have written it if I hadn't challenged her.
Uh-huh. Yeah, thanks, guy.
So we can safely say that Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was the beginning of the sci-fi / horror genre.
Melding. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The marriage of those two genres together. The beginning of the mad scientist horror, because there were a lot of things kind of like the first one that comes to mind for me, which is Reanimator, mm-hmm. is also a lot like...
Very similar, yeah.
Yeah, like the story of Frankenstein. And can I just say right here how much it drives me crazy when I hear people refer to Frankenstein's monster as Frankenstein?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can we stop doing that world now?
Just as a society, let's move on.
Yes. His name is Monster. His name is not Frankenstein. I want to quickly mention there is a comic book series that I read a couple of years ago by Steve Niles and an artist named Damian Worm. And they wrote this amazing comic book series called Monster and Madman, where they kind of rewrite the story of Frankenstein's monster and they connect it to Jack the Ripper.
That's cool.
Ooh.
Yeah, and they bring the two characters together. It's not a very long series, but it is really cool and interesting. And Damian Worm, I became kind of addicted to his artwork when I read this series, and he's still writing. He's still doing a comic book series now, but his artwork is really creepy and like watercolory, and a lot of it sort of looks like old pages that have been torn and burnt around the corners. He puts a lot of detail into just like shaping the panels of the pages to fit what's happening on the page. But really cool story. It's a complete reimagining of what happened to Frankenstein's monster, and he meets Jack the Ripper and things go down.
I'm pretty sure I saw a Looney Tunes episode like that a long time ago too.
What?
Just throwing that out there.
What?
Plagiarism.
I don't know about that, Jackie.
I don't know. I used to watch, well, no, I still watch a lot of cartoons.
So just to keep this fun, let's see some other mad scientist horror ideas here. We've got Reanimator, which is a Lovecraft actually a reference. We've got Frankenstein. We've got Invisible Man, Eyes Without a Face, Ex Machina, which is one of my favorite sci-fi films in the past few years. That one's really weird and strange. I actually had trouble figuring out where to fit Ex Machina because it's also sort of a robot technology sci-fi.
Kind of robot takeover.
But
robot
it's overcoming right. man. But it's kind of the mad scientist too, right?
Yeah, it's kind of right in between those two.
And we can't forget to talk about BioShock.
No, BioShock, the series, is one of my favorite game franchises. It's incredible.
Oh my gosh, BioShock. I can't say that I played it because I didn't. I tried to play it. I think I've talked about it here before, so I don't want to bore everybody.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm terrible at it. But I have watched all of the games played through, and I think they're beautiful and incredible. And yeah, there's that.
They're very very inventive and very nicely colored. The graphics in them are always wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So what comes next after Mary Shelley? Where do we go after that?
Probably Lovecraft.
Probably, yeah. We have a lot of mad scientist, man-creating monster kind of genre. And then there's also, obviously, anything extraterrestrial falls into sci-fi. And then definitely horror. You get a lot of horror out of that. I have to say my favorite horror movie ever is John Carpenter's The Thing. Which I think we were going to do an episode about practical effects versus creating CG. Effects. Yeah, CG and all that kind of effects. And The Thing is the perfect example of practical effects done right and done so much better than a computer could ever do.
Yeah, completely 100% agreed there.
And The Thing is a remake, if I'm not mistaken. I think you're probably referring to the 1982 version with Kurt Russell, not referring to the 2011 version.
I didn't even see
that. I didn't see it. I think it was a different team going back and kind of rediscovering the alien creature, but I also didn't see it, so I don't know.
Mega Nerd Media, we just posted on our Facebook page today, actually. The Scream Factory, which is a group that makes special collector's editions of various films, they're going to be releasing a special edition of The Thing, which has got like a huge amount of crazy extra materials on it, and all kinds of fancy stuff that I don't know how to talk about. There is a new audio mix. There's audio commentary with the director, with co-producers, trailers, TV spots, radio spots.
Dang.
Still gallery. New sounds from The Cold, which is interviews with the sound editor from the film. Just so much stuff. New Back into the Cold, a return to the shooting locations of The Thing. An animated photo gallery, which is narrated by Todd Cameron of Outpost 31. Just a huge amount of extra stuff.
That sounds awesome.
So yeah, if you're a big fan of The Thing, you might want to check out the Scream Factory's The Thing.
Mm-hmm. And I just thought, in keeping with the literary, going through time, we have to mention H.G. Wells right here.
Yep.
And War of the Worlds.
Yeah. You know, I may be in the minority here, but how long ago was that remake of the War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise and all that?
Mm-hmm.
I actually kind of liked it. I thought it was kind of fun.
I don't think it was bad.
Yeah.
It was 2005.
2005, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think it was bad. It was definitely intense.
Yeah. It seemed like they did the monsters with the big long legs particularly well is one thing that really stuck with me about it.
The alien that eventually shows up in 10 Cloverfield Lane reminded me a little bit of those.
Yeah?
Yeah, just that kind of very like robotic, electronic alien, you know, kind of.
Very cool. I have a wind-up robot toy of that alien.
From War of the Worlds? That's awesome.
Yeah.
You have something on your shoulder that looks a little bit like that alien.
Uh-oh. No. Oh, God.
No. Your tattoo, silly.
Oh, yeah.
Not sitting on your shoulder.
Yeah, I've got mechanical jellyfish and octopus on me, and I guess those kind of fit into the sci-fi horror genre too. I didn't even think about that. Nice.
Truthfully, the alien stories don't usually interest me quite as much as like the mad scientist or apocalyptic type sci-fi films, with one gigantic exception to that, which is Alien and Aliens.
Yeah.
Which are probably like in the top five of my all-time favorite sci-fi films.
So let me tell you about my first experience seeing Alien.
Tell me.
Because I hated it at first.
Uh-oh. What?
I honestly hated it.
How old were you when you saw it?
That's the thing. I was like 22.
Okay.
And my roommate at the time was building it up so much. He was like, this is the best horror movie you will ever see in your entire life. And it has the absolute scariest, most, you know, jaw-clenching moment ever in horror that has ever happened. So he's like building it up for weeks before I saw it. And I finally just sat there and watched it. And at the end, I'm like, so what scene were you talking about? Was that scary? Like, I don't really get it. But then I mean, if you're watching it at that age, you know, I've already had seen a lot of horror movies by that time and been involved in a lot of horror things, and the buildup always ruins things for me. So that was just a product of that environment, I think. But watching it later on, I was like, oh yeah, this is actually pretty damn awesome. This is actually a quintessential horror movie for a damn good reason. It is amazing.
Did you see, you saw Alien before Aliens, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I know a decent amount of people who saw Aliens first only because it was more recent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they were too young to see Alien, you know, when it was fresh. I think I found it more interesting. I think it was something that Ryan told me, that there was more to Ripley's story that was cut out, that you see in like bonus materials later. She apparently had a child, and she had to leave her child in order to go on this expedition, and had promised her child that she would be home, I think, by her 12th birthday.
Hmm.
And then obviously was never returned home. She never made it back. So, and her child, you know, by the time she came home from that expedition, her child had grown into an adult and had died. I can't recall why she died, but so when you go into Aliens, the part of the story, you know, with Ripley meeting Newt, the little girl who's lost on the planet, has a little bit more significance when you realize that she's sort of going through this personal thing of trying to make up for her failure as a parent.
Yeah.
That would hold a lot more significance. That's kind of weird that it was cut out there.
If the audience had known that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did either of you play Alien Isolation, the latest Alien game?
No, not yet.
We started it.
That one, I'm pretty sure you play as her daughter, right?
Amanda, I believe is her name.
Yeah, I didn't even really put together the daughter thing until Tucker started playing that game and I was watching him and was talking about her daughter going through. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess she does have a daughter. Kind of didn't even put things together.
Ryan started playing it. I haven't played it myself yet. It's very much like in the vein of Insomnia and things like that, where I don't believe you get any kind of real weapons. It's all about stealth and survival. It is very, I will say, from what I've seen of it so far, it's very loyal to the vibe of the original Alien film. You have that feeling. I think the story is that Amanda is sent back to investigate this ship that was a civilian ship. There were civilians on board. It was supposed to be a almost like a space airport. It was a place where ships come in and out of, and something happened and they lost communication. So you get thrown onto the ship that is obviously now very a mess, and like everything's destroyed and you can't find anybody, and really creepy long moments of crawling through these tiny spaces where there's like abandoned suitcases and luggage everywhere, and
right, that's the game that
sirens going off and weird glowy lights, and
yeah, that's a game that I mentioned a while back. I saw a few virtual reality videos of this game, and it looks incredible to play it from a VR angle, like ducking behind pipes and like physically looking around to see if the alien is there, and creeping behind things to try to get away from the monster, which I think looks really awesome.
When the game starts out, it's almost sort of grainy at the beginning, and the sounds, the way that the game introduces, you feel like you're watching a new Alien film. It feels like it's just a continuation of Alien.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's really a great representation of the franchise.
One thing about the original movie that I thought was really cool was the whole chest bursting scene.
And
I'm sure you guys have probably heard this by now, but apparently the actors around, you know, watching over the table there with the chest bursting scene, they weren't told that something was going to pop out of his chest. So those reactions were completely real. Like, those were legitimate reactions because they just completely shocked those actors by, like, shooting this little xenomorph out. So
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
if anybody is as big of an Aliens fan as we are, we just celebrated Aliens' 30th anniversary on, let's see, what was it? Friday, I believe. On MeganNerdMedia.com, we published a really fun article for Aliens' 30th anniversary where Ryan runs down 30 kind of trivia things about the Alien films. Well, actually about Aliens. I'm sorry. It's not both of them. He just covers Aliens because that's the one celebrating its 30th anniversary. So it's okay. This really fun list of 30 like trivia things that you probably don't know about Aliens. And I know a lot of stuff about Aliens, but I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I found it really fun to read. And
I'm a sucker for those kinds of lists.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, our editor, my husband, Ryan, is going to be doing an ongoing series now called The Nerdy 30, where he's going to celebrate a 30th anniversary film at least once a month and do a list of fun trivia facts about it.
Very cool.
So we started with Aliens because that's, yeah, a favorite.
That's a good one to start on.
Yeah, so it's really fun to read if you guys want to check that out sometime and just... Like Jackie just gave you a little sneak preview. Something I learned when we were talking about the show that has to do with Aliens before we get off of Aliens that I found really interesting. And this is nothing too deep. It's just from the Aliens Wikipedia page. There was a philosopher named Stephen Mulhall who remarked that the four Alien films represent an artistic rendering of the difficulties faced by the woman's voice to have itself heard in a masculinist society, as Ripley continually encounters males who try to silence her and to force her to submit to their desires. Mulhall sees this depicted in several events in Aliens, particularly the inquest scene in which Ripley's explanation for the deaths and destruction of the Nostromo, as well as her attempts to warn board members of alien danger, are met with officious disdain. He believes Ripley's relationship with Hicks in Aliens illustrates that Aliens is devoted to the possibility of modes of masculinity that seek not to stifle, but rather to accommodate the female voice, and modes of femininity that can acknowledge and incorporate something more or other of masculinity than our worst nightmares of it. So I found this really interesting because I think what he was getting at was basically that Ripley's character very much represents the struggle of women and female characters in this genre to be heard and to be characters of power or of importance.
Yeah, yeah. More than just getting murdered or kidnapped right in the beginning of the film.
Yeah. Right. Or the damsel in distress.
Yeah.
And thinking about it in that context and the year that Alien came out in 1979, that's like ahead of its time for that.
Yeah, if you, I didn't think about this as much, but when I went back and saw Aliens recently again, I know exactly the scene that he's referring to where Ripley is being, her inquest in which she's being questioned about what happened on the Nostromo. And the men are very much treating her as if she's sort of this crazy over-emotional woman who's just saying crazy things, you know? She doesn't know what happened because she's emotional and she's lost her grip on reality.
Like, oh, are you having the hysteria? Do you need a tampon?
Hysteria.
Funny, we're always attacked by aliens the same time every month.
Yep. What a weird coincidence.
You want to scream at the screen, like, what?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, there are aliens. You guys are all going to die.
And if you watch Alien and then and you see the shit that she went through and how hard she worked to survive, and then imagine being finally getting out of that place and surviving, and you're with humans again, and the first thing they do is
belittle you.
Belittle you and chastise you and sort of act like you're this child who couldn't handle the hardships of being in space. And it's just like, she survived when all those men on that planet fell apart. She's the one person that came out of it in one piece, and there she's still being treated as if, you know, she was just losing her mind, and what she says doesn't hold any real in fact, they immediately, you know, they immediately stick her back on a ship and send her back out there again. Well, we know you said that there were these big scary things, but we're just going to take you for a ride back there and find out if you're telling the truth. Like, what the hell?
Let's just test that theory. Get back in there.
We're going to look under the bed and show you that there's no monsters there.
Here's a little flashlight for you.
Yeah, here's your little pink flashlight.
Oh,
we're sure it was just rats.
Face huggers.
Yeah, and Ripley is such the quintessential female lead. Like, if it can happen to her, it can happen to any of us, guys.
I mean, Ripley still to this day is, you know, anytime the subject of horror sci-fi comes up, and especially if the subject of great female leads comes up, you're never gonna not be able to talk about her. I mean, she still is a relevant figure.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is, thanks to Sigourney Weaver and Mary Shelley, we have sci-fi and horror.
That is true.
Thanks, ladies.
Yeah.
Which she sort of, Sigourney Weaver then led to Ghostbusters, where she played...
Zool.
Yep.
Zool.
It was.
Which Dana. Then... Dana is her character name. Yeah, there Dana. We go. I was thinking Delilah, but I knew that wasn't right.
Which then leads to the current day Ghostbusters, who I think are for a while going to stand out in people's memories as great female leads in sci-fi, too.
At the very least, Kate McKinnon will.
My girlfriend.
Yeah, our girl. Got to get her on the podcast. So I think that the last kind of genre or category that we still have left to talk about is probably apocalypse and infection virus taking over kind of horror movies.
Oh, this is my favorite one.
Related to that, we actually had a comment on the Twitters. Okay, so we had a comment from Jeremy Hatchett saying, please talk about Fallout for the entire episode.
Maybe not the entire episode, but yeah, let's go.
Which, have either of you played the Fallout games at all?
I have.
I haven't played it, but Tucker plays it endlessly, so I feel like I've played it multiple times.
It's a really cool world, I think. It's,
yeah, it is.
One thing that I didn't know until I was actually doing a little research for this, was supposedly it was supposed to be the video game version of GURPS, which is like a general universe role-playing system. So basically like the D&D rules, but not the D&D world. And it was supposed to be turned into a video game, and that was meant to be Fallout. But something fell through with the trademark, so they went through in this whole other direction here. It still has some of that role-playing elements to it. But the world they created for it with the very nuclear family and 1950s style inside the vault. And, you know, everything is honky-dory and, you know, hey, Jim, how's it going? How's your wife? Kind of thing. And then you get out into the outside the vault and it's this post-apocalyptic wasteland, which is pretty fucking rad. A very Mad Max style with a lot of monsters, and of course the biggest monster is always man. It's just a reoccurring theme. Yeah, like the ghouls, the irradiated humans, they're coming at you. One thing that I would question though is if that's really horror. It seems more like a sci-fi adventure to me. There are horror elements there, but thematically, I think it fits more into sci-fi adventure. I know we're going to try not to cut with a with a cleaver here in terms of semantics, but it seems more...
Well, this is kind of the question, right? And the title of this episode, I believe, will be Where Sci-Fi and Horror Meet. So that's the big question. How do you consider something sci-fi horror, or how do you break it down into just sci-fi or just horror? For me, I just think if there's anything involved, if something in there is scary and it's going to kill you, then it counts as horror.
That's fair. That does paint with a pretty broad brush, but it makes sense.
Fallout scares the heck out of me.
That's fair.
I started Fallout 4. I haven't played very far into it, but there's some really scary shit in there.
One thing I want to mention in terms of setting the mood for Fallout is Ron Perlman does the intro for the original Fallout. And Ron Perlman, I am basically in love with this man. I'm convinced that he is a shark in a man suit, for one. but he's been doing some incredible voice roles. And of course, you know, we're all geeks over here, so we're going to know him from Hellboy for sure. But he's the Lich right now on Adventure Time. And I don't know
if you guys.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys watched that, but like, holy shit, the way he delivers those lines as the Lich. Like, this is a kid show. And yes, yeah. I watch it religiously, but that's besides the point. Like, the way the Lich comes on and just really flips the main character's worlds upside down, and the way he delivers those lines, I swear to God, the whole Citadel escape from the prison arc that they had on there, that is the most metal thing I have ever seen. And it is a kid show. It's insane. But so Ron Perlman jumping on board, narrating anything at all, I'm going to be there. Like, I'm absolutely, it's going to pique my interest just because he's involved.
What else was he? He was also really great in Sin City. Was he?
Yeah. And he was in Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
Which, that's not really a horror, but...
He's a bit of a monster, though.
Yeah, he is a bit of a monster. But while we're touching on that, just a fun little fact there. Ron Perlman plays a leader of this motorcycle gang. Never in the entire filming of that entire show did he ever get his bike over second gear. He was terrified of the motorcycle, and he never got it. Got it up to second gear.
That's funny.
So this gigantic man that looks like a shark parading around in a man suit, terrified of motorcycles. I love it.
The apocalypse area is my personal favorite, and I think there's another kind of piece of this puzzle that we have to throw in here if we're going to talk about apocalypse sci-fi horror, which is zombies.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And there's this huge debate among the horror world and the nerd community. What is it that makes something a zombie? And some of these zombie films, and this, I realize this is a huge conversation, so we can't get too far into this, but you know, a lot of apocalypse films do involve zombies, and some of those zombies are people who have died and returned to life, and some of them are people who got really nasty colds and turned into terrible things. One of my personal favorites in this area is The Crazies, which is a remake. I actually really love the remake.
I've seen that one.
Oh, it's one of my favorites, and we've watched it over and over again. It's one of our, it's on our list here at the house of movies we will always throw on for anybody who requests it, regardless of how many times we've seen it. It's got Timothy Oliphant in it, who I really love to watch because he's so cute. Yeah, really great. It's from 2010, and I know that it's a remake. I think the original was from the 1970s, I believe. But it's a virus that hits this town, and these people don't become zombies per se, because they're still able to pick up tools and use mechanical things. They're still able to function almost like people, but they very much just sort of lose their mind and go crazy in this really unsettling way. The film starts with I don't think this is a spoiler, it's kind of the opening of this film, but with a man who is one of the first to be taken by the illness, and he decides to burn his home and his family, and they find find him just sort of sitting in front of his house waiting for people to show up, and
dang.
With this very kind like glazed over, you know, he's got nothing to say. He's just
like, yeah,
bye bye.
Why not?
Yeah.
That very much reminds me. Have you ever seen the movie The Signal?
No.
No.
First of all, it's incredible. It's not the remake, it's the British version. But it actually has a very similar plot in that people weren't quite zombies. They were still functioning, but they just went absolutely absolutely insane. Like, there's one particular scene there where they're having a birthday party and the main characters stumble on the party, and it goes from very suburban, happy family having a party kind of scene mm-hmm. to suddenly the mother is looking at you with a crazy eye and a butcher knife. And it's it's really cool. It has to do with actually a radio signal infecting people. So that would actually, it fits very nicely into the sci-fi horror genre too. And that's definitely one of my favorites in that genre.
So that reminds me of the movie Pontypool. Have either of you seen that one?
No. I have. That's a great zombie flick.
Oh, it's so good. And it's another zombie that's like not really zombie, but it also is. I would categorize it as infection more.
Right on.
Personally, I totally assume, I consider people who are struck by illness and disease or chemicals to be zombies. I don't think that they have to die and come back to be considered a zombie. And the reason I say that is because if we're going to be talk about semantics, then technically a zombie is someone who is overtaken by a curse of voodoo. The term zombie was never really meant to mean something that died and came back. We just kind of let George Romero take that term for a while to mean that. So,
yeah, it's used colloquially in that sense of somebody who has completely lost all sense of being a human, I guess.
Yeah, in other words, I feel like if we can take it from meaning one thing and make it mean people who die and come back to life, then we can also take it and make it mean people who get really sick and become insane.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
And act like zombies. So,
yeah, I think that there is maybe a distinction with what the virus does to the people. And like in the example of maybe 28 days later, 28 weeks later, I think that's the one that always comes up when people are arguing this argument, where the rage virus kind of gives them superhuman strength, kind of gives them, lets them run really fast. They don't get tired the way that muscles would get tired. So maybe in the case of where the infection or the sickness or something kind of transforms you into a superhuman, then maybe you're not a zombie anymore. I think a zombie is something that deteriorates.
Yeah.
And maybe is driven by a desire to eat rather than to kill.
Right. But in 28 days later...
But I also agree it's kind of dumb. Just
They did kind of decay in terms of, you know, organic material.
Like over time, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because they weren't eating and they weren't functioning, right? They weren't eating food.
They didn't have the fuel that they needed, yeah.
Right.
I consider those zombies. Those two are my two of my all-time favorite zombie films.
Those movies are so
mine
good.
Too. And it's not just because of Cillian Murphy's eye and the, like, piercing eyes there.
So it begs the question that I'm curious for you two. Are you two more afraid of the slow-moving zombie or the fast-moving zombie?
Definitely the fast-moving zombie, I think.
I agree.
Yeah?
The event of slow moving zombies, it's always the case where the man is the monster.
Yeah.
Again.
Always.
And always. But when you have fast moving zombies, you don't really have time for man to become the monster.
Right.
You're kind of dead before they get the chance to.
Right.
There's no time to argue, right?
Yeah. The villains that, you know, come at you slowly and so confidently being terrifying, I think to me at least only works if that villain is able to actually process what they're doing, and you know, they like, it feels like they know something that you don't, if they're gonna take you down. But when it comes to a zombie running at full speed and I'm over here like, damn it, why did I have that cupcake last week, because this guy's gonna catch up to me. Yeah, I'm not gonna survive the zombie apocalypse, guys.
Yeah, to be fair, I don't want to live in a post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah,
I would much rather kind of die early if there's no chance of reclaiming civilization. So maybe in that case, the slow-moving zombies are a little worse, because you'd rather just die off in the beginning rather than have to like survive in the subpar.
And then you'd have to make the conscious decision of, well, I could kill this slow-moving zombie, but do I want to?
Yeah. Is it really worth it? I could just walk a little faster, be a little quieter.
Stubbs has taught me that they work really well as defensive walls.
Yeah.
To protect yourself. You hide behind the zombie horde, and then you can't get attacked by the bad humans on the other side.
That was definitely Michonne's whole defense in The Walking Dead, which I appreciated.
And she's still alive.
Yeah.
According to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have the bad luck of running into those World War Z zombies who just stack themselves on top of each other like a wave and roll over everything.
Then it's just a natural disaster at that point. It's just a tsunami of bodies.
Zombie tsunami.
Trademark, Sci-Fi has to give us money if they make that.
How long do you think it'll be before Sci-Fi makes that movie?
Zombie tsunami coming this fall.
That is actually a game. Have you ever played Zombie Tsunami?
No.
It is actually a fun game.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a mobile game, and Max adores it. It's one of his favorite games. It's a little scrolling kind of platform game where you have this little zombie, and you have to jump over cars that come at you, and then you gobble up people along the way, and you build your zombie horde the more people you eat. So
that's hilarious.
It's really
Max
cute.
Is gonna grow up to be so cool.
He loves zombies. Also in this category is one of Jackie's favorites, I Am Legend, right?
Yeah, and that's another one of those not quite decrepit zombies kind of thing. I mean, they're more vampires than anything. But yeah, that's one of those questions of is that really, what kind of monster is that, and exactly how afraid of you are it? Especially because that it varies by version of it. I mean, in each movie, I feel like it varies quite a bit. But in the book, like, they're very lucid. The monsters are out there psychologically torturing you. Like, it's not so much about physical harm. It's that they're, like, in there saying, hey, dude, you want to chill? I want to chill. Come on out. We can do this.
I don't think they want to be friends.
No.
It would just be so much easier if you gave yourself over to us.
Yeah.
There is one more fun category here that we haven't talked about yet. And that is the, as my husband so eloquently calls it, what the fucking space horror.
That's right. What the fuck is going on out in space?
Yeah, what the fuck is happening? And that is there's one of my favorite films in there that I asked you two to watch that I don't know if you'd seen before. I think both of you rewatched it. That's Sunshine.
Yeah.
Speaking of Cillian Murphy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, those eyes.
Piercing eyes. There's a lot of people in this film, which is also a Danny Boyle movie, who did 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later. Chris Evans is in this, which is really funny to see Captain America all scruffy with long hair and...
He did some strange parts before he was Captain America.
Yeah, Rose Byrne, that's her name. I really like her. There's a few people in this that show up that, like, you go back now. This movie is from 2007. So you go back now and you rewatch this and, like, oh, that's so-and-so. You recognize a lot of actors that came out of this and are doing kind of big things now. Cliff Curtis is actually in Fear the Walking Dead right now.
Oh, cool.
TV show offshoot from The Walking Dead. So what did you guys think after watching this?
Honestly, the biggest thing that stood out to me, and I mean, I've thought this before, but it brought it up again. There is a Doctor Who episode called 42, which is just basically Sunshine. And it made me think about how often sci-fi horror plots are reused. And I mean, there's also a Futurama episode that's kind of loosely based on the idea of going to the sun and the whole dangerous mission and bringing the monster on board with you, all that kind of stuff. And I wonder, like, how many plots are there that really fit into the sci-fi horror genre? Are we really, like, running out of those? Like, why are we reusing them so often?
Well, I guess there's only so many ways you can destroy the Earth, right?
We need some new inventive ways of destroying the Earth.
Let's see, zombies, illness, planets, aliens.
Yeah.
Robots. Don't forget robots.
Yeah.
Robots. Yeah. This one I really love in particular because as soon as we started talking about the whole idea of where sci-fi meets horror, I felt like this movie really embodies that really well.
Yeah.
Because through the majority of the film, you're definitely dealing with that idea of, you know, people being, we are our own worst enemies. These people who are under a huge amount of pressure and they're on this mission to save the sun, to keep the Earth alive, and they know that they're the last people with any chance to do this. This is our last chance to save humanity. So they're under a huge amount of pressure, and they're all in this tiny quarters where they're stuffed together for a long amount of time, floating around in space in a very dangerous environment. And
so it basically starts out like a bad season of Real World from MTV in space. Right,
right.
Oh man, you guys, the Real World is filming in Seattle right now, and you just can't go to Capitol Hill because it's all just Real World folks.
Yeah, just the testosterone is flying inside of this spaceship. And I just, you know, and then about three quarters of the way into the film, when they go, they try to answer a distress beacon from a lost spaceship who came before them, tried to do the same mission and never came back. Then they get onto this ship and they discover that there's some really nefarious things happening. And it, at that point, it takes a really hard turn into horror territory.
It is a pretty sudden turn in terms of the tone of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it ramps up super fast.
I mean, for me, a lot of space movies feel like horror just because they always feel to me this really unsettling combination of like claustrophobia and also like too much space somehow at the same time, where you're in this, you're in space. So you're in this huge open thing that feels way larger than you and makes you feel just tiny. But then you're also in this tiny little spaceship where you can't move and you can't get out, and you have no ability to like, you have no ability to say, okay, I'm done with this, I want to go home now.
Yeah.
You're just stuck there. So there's always a really, you know, unsettling feeling of too big and too small at the same time in any space film, for me. But this one, I just, and I think the effects of this film are just really beautiful.
Yeah, especially for being made in 2007. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wasn't that long ago, but it was a decade ago.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive when you see the scenes when they're sitting and watching through the observatory looking at the sun.
Yeah.
Really striking to think about how much work they put into that. Another one that it kind of falls into this that was a surprise to me was Pandorum. Did either of you see Pandorum?
I haven't seen that.
That was one that Ryan and I saw, and we didn't expect it to be very good. But it turned out to be really pretty terrifying and scary. It's got Dennis Quaid. It's from 2009, so it's a little older too. And it's these astronauts who wake up in the hypersleep chamber, and they have no memory of where their mission, where they were supposed to be going, and what they were supposed to be doing. They try to figure out what's going on, and they venture out into this abandoned spaceship to try to find anybody. And yeah, there are these really terrifying things living on the spaceship with them, which I don't, can only be described as kind of what men might become after long periods of time of being alone on a spaceship and not having good things to eat.
So basically, they all have scurvy. They're scurvy zombies.
It's kind of like Mad Max in space is what it sort of turns into. Like,
I'm
really
sold.
Yeah, really like terrifying cannibalistic creatures, and it becomes this thing where these people who are left behind on the spaceship are just hiding and trying to survive. And yeah, if you guys look up, just search this one day and look it up and look at some of the images, the physical makeup and the effects for these creatures were really cool and really impressive. It's pretty terrifying. Oh, and Norman Reedus is in this too. I forgot that he was in this.
Oh, nice.
So if you're now a Walking Dead fan, it's kind of cool to see Norman Reedus in an older sci-fi film. Did we talk very much about the robot Ghost in the Machine horror?
Not too much. No, we kind of talked about robots coming back and with Ex Machina and overpowering man. Yeah. And right now I'm playing Soma. I think Jackie started it, maybe?
I haven't started that one. I started Outlast.
Okay.
Haven't gotten into that one quite yet.
I started it. I haven't gotten too far. It's not as spooky as I want it to be.
That's what I've heard. And I'm a little bit weary of playing it because of that. I mean, I'm going to anyway, but...
Mm-hmm. I think, because I assumed it was going to be amnesia underwater. But it hasn't been so far. But it's still been really fun. I also am not the biggest gamer, so I'm just kind of slow with the controls and all of that kind of stuff, but the story of it is pretty cool so far.
Nice.
And you wake up underwater basically, and you have to figure out what's going on.
I don't believe you that it's not scary, but
I'm lying. I'm just setting you up so you'll play it.
I'm working up to it. I've started watching gameplay videos online of it. I think my theory is that if I watch enough gameplay videos, then I'll know what's happening and I won't be as scared.
Right. So you know what to expect, so you won't get that.
Yeah. I need to dampen the suspense a little bit before I get into it.
That's fair. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so far the scariest part is just how dark it gets in there.
Yeah.
Because it's it's a mix of just kind of run down, old, weird cogs and machines and nothing's really working. And then sometimes you'll come across like blinking lights or electrical sockets and things going off. But it's a lot of just trying to find the light switch for me so far.
You haven't come across any of the big scary robots yet?
I have. The couple times that they've shown up, it was mostly just the music getting really intense and I couldn't really see where anything was or where it was coming from. So I guess it's that fear of the unknown of, I don't know what's attacking me right now or where it's coming from, but I'm just going to crouch and hope that I'm behind something.
Yeah, I was watching some of the gameplay with a couple friends here the other day. We finally finished Layers of Fear, and nice. We were watching gameplay videos of Soma after that, and my friend is sitting here. I don't know why this is so scary. I'm like, there's a giant robot with what appears to be blades or something on his arms, and he's charging at you across the room. Like,
that sounds a lot like the Big Daddies in
to me, that's terrifying.
There.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
They're not quite as cool as the Big Daddies. They're not as detailed, and, you know, they don't seem to have as much, like, humanistic character in them. They're very much just kind of machines with a lot of lights on them.
Right on.
Yeah, but I did also see some video of a walking up to a robot on the ground who was begging you to get help for him and seemed to believe that he was a human.
Oh, buddy.
Aww.
It was really sad, yeah. And as I'm watching, they, like, sort of unplug this big thing, this big like cable that's attached to him, and unplug it, and he starts screaming in agony, and then you plug it back in.
Oh no.
And this is the thing I've heard about this game, is that it's not even so much about the horror, but it's about the terrible choices that you're forced to make as mm-hmm. you go through the game, that there's just like there's no good choice, there's no option of being a good person.
That seems like a pretty big trend in games right now, is choice making games and forcing you to make terrible choices and be a terrible person.
Yeah. If you've ever played the Game of Thrones Telltale games, they sort of get like that, where they force you to make these really quick decisions that you feel like no matter which one you choose, somebody's gonna die, which is Game of Thrones in a nutshell.
Yeah, pretty on point.
It's still terrible when you have to make the decision yourself. I think it's worth mentioning Resident Evil, because between games and films, they've got a pretty huge library of sci-fi horror to pull from.
Indeed.
The original Resident Evil is one of my all-time favorites. Films. I actually didn't play the games.
The original Resident Evil games were some of my favorite video games for a long while.
Yeah. They were named among some of our listeners as top sci-fi horror games, so I think they're really popular. I thought the original film was really great, and it scared the crap out of me when I first saw it. It's unfortunate that they went downhill so far after that.
The franchise just has to know when to stop. Honestly.
Yeah.
But one thing that's I just realized isn't on our list that really should be is the Half-Life series. Half-Life, have either of you played either of the Half-Life games?
No. I don't even really know much about them.
It's pretty cool. And it's the Half-Life 2 is often hailed as one of the best video games that was ever made.
Okay.
You are basically, you're a scientist, you're Gordon Freeman, and you work in this big, gigantic, monstrously huge underground facility, working basically with aliens. And then, of course, everything goes awry, because what are you even doing down there, you stupid human? Yeah. And so everything gets fucked, and aliens start invading and killing everybody. And there are these little head crabs that will jump on faces and turn people into zombies. And so they...
Head crabs?
Yeah. They jump on face. And they, I mean, so you have the element of these aliens using humans as their weapons as well, which is kind of rad. And meanwhile, this entire facility is falling apart, and you're basically just trying to get to the surface the entire time to try to get out of this maze, this entire labyrinth of disaster that's happening. And then when you finally get to the surface, there's the military shooting at you and trying to burn this whole thing to the ground, because this was a big mistake that they don't want anybody to find out about. And that's literally just the tip of the iceberg, because later on in the game, you're actually going to go to the alien planet and fight some bitches over there too. And it's one of those games that like you could play over and over again, and it really holds up, except for the graphics. The graphics are terrible. But there have been, you know, thanks to the miracle that is PC gaming, there are mods that make the graphics more updated and bring it into a better engine to run it in, so that the gameplay is a little smoother. But when that was when that first came out, if I recall correctly, the Half-Life games basically kind of invented this this game engine that a lot of PC games were made out of and evolved from at the time. And if either of you ever hear people asking, "Well, when is Half-Life 3 coming out? Where's Half-Life 3?" That's an ongoing question in the gamer community, because that's just never going to happen. It's been years. It's never going to happen. And we're all just sitting here, just slowly decaying. Aww. As we're waiting on Half-Life 3, and we're just not going to get it.
You'll get a Half-Life 3 when Firefly comes back.
Exactly.
Exactly. I think for a long time, people thought that Fallout 4 was never going to happen too, though, right?
Yeah.
It came.
At this point, though, the way Half-Life 3 has been built up and anticipated, like, there's, even if it were the best damn video game that was ever made, it probably wouldn't live up to the expectations.
I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job here if I didn't throw in a couple extra comic series.
Do it,
because that's my thing here. So yeah, Southern Cross is a currently running series by Becky Cloonan, who we all know that I adore because I'm the one that's always posting Becky Cloonan on the Sirens Twitter and Facebook page. And that is a fantastic space story of a woman who goes onto this giant, like, kind of space freighter trying to figure out what happened to her sister who disappeared and died mysteriously. And she runs into a lot of shady characters, and some weird space vibrations happen, and things get really fucked up really quickly. It's a great series. And there's also one of my favorites, like probably top five favorites comic book series in the past few years, is one called Empty Zone, written and art by Jason Sean Alexander. And this is very cyberpunk, post-apocalyptic.
Cool.
Yeah, this really cool character. She was in this elite group of cybernetically enhanced, trained military people who are thrown out into these intense missions where they basically just have to kill a lot of people and do terrible things for the government. And her group were all killed at some point. She's the only one left. And she has this really cool cybernetic thing inside of her head where she's basically a walking flash drive. So, so she can get information and transfer information via her body. And that's how she survives now. She takes these jobs by usually, like, gangsters and, you know, shady people transferring delicate information between people. And she starts seeing the figures and the ghosts of her dead comrades who she used to work with.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's really intense. And so you've got robots, you've got cybernetic enhancements on people. She's got this really, like, rough robotic arm that she just refuses to get, like, a fancy human arm. She just wants this big, like, robot claw.
Cool.
That would be me.
She's very cyberpunk, you know? She just got this, like, she's like, I don't need anything fancy. I just need a big arm. this really tough chick. And yeah, it's a really, really cool series, really beautifully drawn. It's called Empty Zone. And then there's one as well called Low, which is from Rick Remender and Greg Toccini. And this is an underwater post-apocalyptic story of everybody's basically been pushed down below into the water when the earth does crazy things and people can't survive up there anymore. And it's a really intimate and heartbreaking story of a family that's torn apart by like undersea pirates. And
oh no.
Yeah, there's really like terrifying sea creatures and yeah, they're underwater pirates. They're not nice. this one's really cool because this is like a special family. You know, everything undersea has been kind of broken down into like different cities and stuff, and each city has their own sort of guardians. And this family has this suit called a helm suit, which is this giant, you know, weapon-laden suit that they can protect their city with. And this family are the only people that can use that suit. And what happens is they're very valuable. They're valuable people because they can wear this suit and operate it. And they get torn apart. They have this terrible thing happens with these pirates and the family's torn apart. And the daughters are kind of like taken hostage and sold into slavery. And there's this really kind of ongoing thing with the mother is sort of the center of the story. And she has, I guess, what you would call a faith or a religion of sorts that is this idea that if she believes that things will work out for her, then they do, which doesn't usually work out for her. But the whole point of the story is that she has to retain this faith and keep struggling to keep it in order to get her family back together one day.
Yeah.
So, but it is, there's some really terrifying stuff in here. And so I do put it into the horror category.
And what is that called again?
It's called Low.
Okay.
It's got absolutely gorgeous artwork. Really, really beautiful artwork. And I think we're getting close to wrapping this up. Before we wrap this up, I just wanted to ask you guys if you've ever seen Under the Skin.
No.
Mm-mm.
Movie called Under the Skin. It stars Scarlett Johansson. It's an alien film. Very art housey.
Okay.
It's very kind of quiet and still, but I found it really creepy. I will say that there is a particular scene in this film with a child who is sort of abandoned, and it's insinuated that this child dies. And that scene I felt was really unnecessary and drawn out way too long. Yeah. But just as a sort of a content warning, mm-hmm. anyone who's sensitive to that sort of thing, this is not a good film for you, because it was very upsetting to me, and I probably won't go back and watch the movie just because of that scene. But other than that moment, it was really, really cool and completely different, unique story. I've never seen anything like this before. Kind of in vain of like Body Snatchers, but Scarlett Johansson is an alien, and she is disguised as a human female, and she basically is driving around Scotland and luring lonely men into a van and then sort of taking her back to what appears to be her home, but she just sort of walks into the darkness with them as she peels off her clothing slowly, and they kind of disappear into this like black mass of nothingness. Like they just sort of start to sink into the floor, and it's got this really like still and odd and unsettling feeling about it.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, it's not fun. There's nothing fun about this movie. No, it's just really strange. It was completely took me by surprise, but I think it's really worth seeing, especially to see Scarlett Johansson in kind of a different
mm-hmm.
character that she's never played before. I don't remember her even saying anything in the film. I don't know if she ever speaks.
Hmm.
And it's really an interesting twist to watch a female villain, a female monster victimizing these men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's kind of doing like the old, you know, creepy van thing, just driving around and picking up guys in her van. So you guys should check that out. You haven't seen it. It's called Under the Skin.
Little continuation of last week's episode with female villains.
Yeah. totally didn't think to mention that. I guess because she's an alien. I don't think of it as like a villain, you know?
Of like a human. Yeah.
Just, I guess that's just what aliens do. They're just bad. So I don't think of them as villains.
It goes without saying. They are always
portrayed as bad.
I know.
What about E.T.?
That's true.
What was that alien, the film, the weird film with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost?
Oh, Paul.
Paul.
Yeah. I need to rewatch that. That's a fun one.
He wasn't bad.
I just really love Simon and Nick, though. So
speaking of that, the third movie in the Cornetto series
mm-hmm.
falls under the whole sci-fi horror thing. Definitely. With the robots and whatnot. So there you go, Melissa. There are some creepy robots in the... Jesus, what was it even called?
World's End.
Yes, World's End. Thank you. That would have driven me crazy.
I got you.
Yeah. But have you seen World's End?
I don't think I have.
It's really good. Yeah, you would definitely like it. But basically, a bunch of grown-ups go back to their hometown for one last hurrah, and it turns out the entire town has been taken over by murderous robots.
I did see this.
It's awesome.
As soon as I looked it up, I'm like, how did I not see a Simon Pegg film?
Right.
And once I saw the pictures, I realized that that's what I just completely blanked on the name of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really funny. That was a really fun, strange movie.
Mm-hmm. And a little scary sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I will pretty much watch anything that involves Nick Frost, Simon Pegg, and Edgar Wright all together.
Max's middle name is Simon, by the way.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
It's not a completely coincidence. So, I don't know. What do you think,
Are
Sierra?
We forgetting anything else?
I feel like we're forgetting something big.
I'm sure that we are, but I also feel like I know I've definitely heard some things I haven't seen before that I'm going to go run and watch right now. Yeah. Hopefully other people got good recommendations
from
it.
This kind of became like the recommendation show.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm not mad about that.
Neither am I.
How about if I just run down this list really fast? Because yeah, I feel like
that's a good idea.
Ryan made us a great list. And so we don't necessarily have to go into all these things, but it's worth mentioning a lot of them.
Cool.
Maybe some of them. Maybe Leprechaun 4 in space we could skip. Thanks, Ryan. So let's see, under alien horror we've got Alien, The Thing, Bad Taste, The Blob, which is a good old fun one.
Mm-hmm.
Slither, Critters, Under the Skin, Village of the Damned, Species, Predator, and War of the Worlds, which we totally did not talk about Predator.
Oh yeah, we spent all that time talking about Sigourney Weaver.
I know. I love the Predator monsters, but I never loved the plots, so I just love the monsters. I thought they were a great design and terrifying alien. Body-stealing horror, we have things like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Invaders from Mars. We talked about Mad Scientist horror. Body transformation or existential horror, we have things like From Beyond, Altered States, The Fly, which is a pretty big one that we're going to talk about. The Brood, Shivers, Videodrome. Videodrome is a great classic favorite of a lot of horror films.
A little aside here, I saw Altered States back when I lived in Asheville. There was a local theater that did a local free horror night every Thursday, and they would show old horror classics in this like really comfy theater with couches. If any of you run movie theaters, do that. It's so cool. It's the coolest thing. I've literally made lifelong friends there.
I think I saw Altered States at the wrong time in life because I was too young and I was just kind of like, I don't know what the hell this is. Mm-hmm. This is weird.
Yeah. Give it another shot. It's a pretty good movie if you watch it at the right time.
Yeah. We have interdimensional horror like The Mist and Phantasm. Phantasm, seeing that as a teenager, gave me a forever fear of funeral homes. I just assume that every funeral home has a terrible face mangling sphere.
They do.
Rolling around in it. Yeah. Cross-genre things. We have things like Jason X in space.
Oh, God.
We have Hellraiser Bloodlines, which was in space. Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And Life Force, which was space vampires. I gotta give props to my husband. I never would have come up with that section at all.
But I'm glad it's there.
That is by far the most inventive section of our list here.
The infected virus is an interesting one because we have lots of different types of zombies in here. We've got the crazies, who we talked about, 28 weeks and days later. Romero zombies, which were crashed satellite zombies. We have Return of the Living Dead zombies, which were... 2-4-5 Triaxin chemical zombies. We have I Am Legend, World War Z, and Resident Evil. Resident Evil, I believe, was also chemical, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and The Signal would fall under that as well.
Okay. We have robot technology ghost in the machine horror, which is things like Hardware, Chopping Mall, Lawnmower Man, Maximum Overdrive. Oh, that's a good one. Ex Machina and Soma. And we forgot Event Horizon, which falls into What the Fuck in Space.
Definitely.
And I know there's tons more of Apocalypse. I don't know if Fury Road really fits in as horror, but I'm going to put it in there because it's one of the best movies ever made. So I think that's everything.
Yeah, at least a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to tell us all the things we forgot, you can tweet us at Sirens of Scream on Twitter.
And we actually have a question there.
The question is from at Evil Hobbs, which is a great name, mm-hmm. on Twitter. What are your favorite moments in sci-fi horror?
Oof.
Which we talked about a lot of them. Maybe if we just sort of, let's play the first thing that comes to your head game.
Mine would definitely be in BioShock. The first BioShock, right when you're coming up on the first little sister and you choose whether to take her life or save her. And you're making a big decision there. And the feel, the atmosphere in that section is incredible. And it just really sets the tone for the entire game.
What about you, Sierra?
I just want to mention, because we completely forgot to talk about it, but Slither was on that list. Uh-huh. I think about that poster a lot. I don't know what it is exactly about it, but it's the image of the girl in the bathtub and the black little slugs like crawling over to her. For some reason, every time I take a bath, I think about that. So that was the first thing that popped into my head.
Those imageries that stick with you.
Yeah. Oh, and it kind of reminds me of Melissa's point about space horror and being in space and the emptiness of it, and being very exposed. I feel like also that image of being in a bathtub with weird alien things wiggling up to you feels very exposed. I know. It's gross.
There's a lot, so it's hard for me to come up with a moment, but one that's popping into my head right now is from the remake of The Crazies. Mm-hmm. There's a moment when they have tried to put the infected people in quarantine. They've got them in a tent and some of them are still being tested to see if they're ill or not. And they're tied down to gurneys in a big mm-hmm. room. And the makeshift hospital is taken over by the crazies. They get in. And there's a really terrible and unsettling moment where there's a woman on the gurney, two women next to each other on gurneys who are not infected. And they're watching the crazies.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's a guy walking through the room, making his way around the gurneys and basically murdering anyone who moves.
Oh,
and they're just tied there waiting for him to make his way over to them. And it's just really intense, really really unnerving moment in the movie that I love. There's a kind of mm-hmm. like the big tent around them. So there's shadows everywhere and they can't see what's outside the tent. They're just tied down to these gurneys, just watching this crazy guy walk around and kill people.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's one of my favorite moments.
It's worth mentioning Evil Hobbs on Twitter, who asked us that question. He said that one of his favorite scenes is a xenomorph breathing on Ripley's face in Alien 3, which is just such an iconic scene. Mm-hmm, I love mm-hmm. that so much.
Maybe only overshadowed by her get away from her, you bitch moment.
Yeah.
She comes out in the big forklift machine. The moms facing each other.
It's a mom showdown.
Yep.
Well, cool. Anything else you guys want to throw in?
Our next show is going to be Final Girl with a guest spot from Corey Chandler.
He's a writer and does some really cool, creepy artwork, too.
You can find him on Twitter as Dark Writes.
Sirens of Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit meganerdmedia.com for geek-related content, columns, reviews, interviews, and videos, including Ryan's cool Aliens Top 30 cool facts you didn't know. That I'm going to go read right now and then tell all my friends and they'll think I'm really cool. If you would like to, you can reach us on email at sos@meganerdmedia.com and on Twitter, as we mentioned before. And I want to mention that we made a Tumblr. So we are on Tumblr now. If you're on there, we're sirensofscream.tumblr.com. If you want to go give us a follow.
Sierra's been doing an awesome job with putting really cool stuff on there, guys. Check it out.
I've been reblogging lots of weird art and stuff.
So you can just get your sirens filled constantly throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jackie, where can people find you on the internets?
I am on Twitter and Instagram as Jackie the Robot, all one word.
And Melissa, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram as well at Lissa Punch.
Awesome. And I'm at Sierra Hauk on Instagram and Twitter and Tumblr and all that. And that's a wrap.